As commented on by Dr. Blanke, there's been a recent flurry of activity surrounding KRAS mutation testing and the efficacy of anti-EGFR antibodies. I met with Dr. Steve Alberts to chat about a number of new data sets, but we began with a paper his team presented at ASCO on KRAS and BRAF testing.
With our trial of FOLFOX with or without cetuximab, there had been interest in looking at a variety of factors that might have helped predict who was going to respond in the adjuvant setting to the addition of an EGFR inhibitor, in this case cetuximab. As I think everybody's well aware from last year's ASCO presentation, we showed that adding cetuximab did not enhance outcomes in terms of three-year disease-free survival in resected stage 3 colon cancer in patients receiving FOLFOX. Then we've gone back to try to look at subgroups. Partway through that trial, N0147, we had switched from treating everybody with either FOLFOX or FOLFOX cetuximab to only treating patients who had wild-type KRAS, given the data to say that patients with mutated KRAS do not respond to EGFR inhibitors. The poster this time was meant to look even beyond that to certain specific mutations within KRAS, with the JAMA article that came out recently showing that there is one KRAS mutation, G13D, where patients who have a specific mutation still seem to respond to EGFR inhibitors, and we wanted to make sure that we did not overlook that in N0147. Our results showed that in the adjuvant setting, in the patients that we enrolled, there was no benefit even within that group.
How many patients did you have with that particular mutation?
With that particular mutation, it was about 260 patients.
Wow. But, you know, that was a little kind of bothersome to me. Is it possible or likely in the metastatic setting that by using broad KRAS mutation testing, we're going to miss these patients? Well, we know we're going to miss these patients,
yes,
but that it'll make a difference?
Given both the JAMA article and then a presentation by Sabine Pajpar at the oral session of ASCO, again emphasizing from the European data that this one subgroup does benefit, it raises the point that when we're doing KRAS testing that we need to look at specific subgroups so that we don't miss that particular patient population. While it's small, you certainly don't want to deprive them of the opportunity to use an EGFR inhibitor. Clearly, the difficult part will be making people aware of that information. And as we're performing more and more of these specific analyses on genetic mutations within the tumor, it's going to be important not only to provide the result to treating physicians, but what does this mean?
So this G13D mutation, what fraction of KRAS mutations do you think represent this subtype?
It represents roughly about 25% of mutations.
So maybe 25% of the people we've been excluding from these therapies actually could benefit?
Potentially so.
Interesting. There are a couple of papers that have been published recently you've been involved with. I wanted to just get your take on. One was the journal Cancer, actually just a couple of months ago. The first author, Gill, Prognostic Web-Based Models for Stage 2 and 3 Colon Cancer, where you basically looked at the Mayo Clinic web model, Numeracy, and Peter Rabdin's Adjuvant Online. Can you talk about what you looked at there and where we are right now in terms of particularly trying to look at prognosis and response or benefits from treatment in stage 2 colon cancer?
Sure. One of the difficulties, certainly when we sit with a patient, is to talk about what is the potential benefit of adjuvant therapy. And a lot of us have in our minds the overall results of large trials like Mosaic or the NSCBP C07 trial and talk about it in terms of all patients independent of how many lymph nodes were involved or the T status or the tumor grade. Both the Numeracy and Adjuvant Online are meant to try to refine based on some of the factors such as number of nodes involved, the T stage, the grade of the tumor, what is the likelihood of benefit, and therefore be able to better educate patients in regard to expectations if they should move forward with adjuvant therapy, how much benefit are they truly going to get out of it. Both of the programs were built looking at older data that had been collected through trials of surgery with or without any sort of post-operative therapy, and then trying to add into that the results of trials like C07 or Mosaic to build on the benefits with oxaliplatin. This particular paper was a study trying to compare the two and further refine how well are they working in predicting response to therapy, suggesting there are still areas where both of these tools may need some further tweaking to be able to provide as accurate information as we can for patients. Clearly, I think we've seen other reports come out to say that there's some stage 3 patients who have a pretty low risk of recurrence. There's some stage 2 patients that clearly have a very high risk. And as we start to counsel patients about therapy and try to better individualize our recommendations, it's helpful to have these tools to provide that sort of information.
Now, you know, in other tumors, and particularly breast cancer, we've moved into the genomic era. And for a lot of patients, most of the patients who have node negative tumors are getting the Oncotype DX. And there actually is an Oncotype DX in colon cancer. What do we know about that? And what do you think about it?
Sure. The Oncotype DX assay for colon cancer was built in sort of a similar paradigm as it was for breast cancer, going back and looking at large databases of patients, trying to select genes that would help provide a better understanding of the stage 2 patients, who's going to have a relapse following surgery, and then who may really benefit from adjuvant therapy if that risk of relapse is high enough. In this case for colon cancer, I think there are a couple important differences. The colon cancer assay only provides information about the risk of recurrence. It does not provide any information about potential benefit to chemotherapy, where the breast Oncotype assay does provide some information there. The colon assay just became available, and I think there's still a lot of people trying to understand how much does it fit into their daily practice, and does it really change their decision-making when they meet with a patient with stage 2 colon cancer? It is an area, again, where there are certain patients that are at higher risk. And you should just clarify that for this particular assay, they're really focused on the intermediate risk patients. It's not meant for somebody who has a T4 tumor that had perforation, the really high risk patients where you might consider treating somebody just based on those clinical factors. And it also removes the patients that have deficiency in mismatch repair, where they have a very low risk of recurrence. So you're left with that group in between where there's approximately 10 to maybe up to close to 30% risk of recurrence. If we're going to use chemotherapy, we'd certainly want to focus on that higher end of the spectrum. And this particular assay is meant to try to help clarify where somebody fits along that spectrum.
I guess the thing that we've seen evolve in breast cancer has been an emphasis not so much on prognosis, but more on the absolute benefit of treatment. And in that regard, do you think that the information provided by this assay, I mean, I'm seeing that there are people actually using the colon assay in community-based practice, for better or worse. Do you think that this assay provides information that can give the physician a better idea of actually what the absolute benefit of chemotherapy is going to be?
Not directly. I think we're unfortunately left with information that's derived from trials like C07 or Mosaic to say within that subgroup of patients who are enrolled with stage 2 colon cancer, how much benefit did they gain from chemotherapy overall, and then trying to apply that to the risk of recurrence based on the Oncotype assay and derive some potential benefit for a patient from those two pieces of information.
So the other paper I wanted to ask you about, co-authored by Dr. Hubbard in the Cancer Journal, treatment of liver-limited metastatic colorectal cancer, one of my favorite topics, something that you've helped us out a lot in terms of education over the years, and I know you have a lot of interest in. Why don't we actually get into this topic by talking about the 58-year-old man that you sent in as a case to present here?
This is a 58-year-old man with resected stage 3 colon cancer that had presented to Mayo about 18 months after his initial surgery to resect his colon cancer. His situation was somewhat unique in that he had several postoperative surgical complications, including wound dehiscence and astigmatic leak that prevented him from going on to receive adjuvant therapy by the time he recovered from those problems. It was both a patient and a physician decision not to proceed with any chemotherapy and just watch. In his situation, about 18 months after he had gone through the initial surgery during a routine screen, he was found by CT to have some new nodules in the liver that were small in size but ranged from about 0.5 to 1.8 centimeters. Along with that, his CEA that had been normal was starting to go up.
These were bilateral?
These, by the CT scan, were only in the right lobe of the liver during his initial evaluation.
I guess another question that comes up in these cases is sort of the location and whether or not it's close to any critical structure that might make surgery difficult. How about in his situation?
In his situation, these were not adjacent to critical structures that would have prevented resection. This is a setting where at initial presentation, it's really helpful to have that surgical evaluation to assess should these be resected immediately? Is there benefit to some initial chemotherapy and then resection? At what point should a resection be done if a person is receiving some initial chemotherapy? In this particular setting, the patient who had been seen elsewhere had received the recommendation that he should undergo 3 months of chemotherapy with FOLFOX and then be seen by a surgeon for a potential right hepatectomy.
Now, did he have a liver biopsy?
He did not have a liver biopsy in this case. Given the rising CEA and the findings on the scan, it was felt to be consistent with metastatic disease.
Would you have biopsied him?
I think in general, for first recurrence, we have been biopsying patients just to confirm indeed it is metastatic disease. Well, the vast majority of times it will be. Occasionally we're surprised by something else that appears there, and we certainly don't want to make a mistake and treat something inappropriately.
So what was the next step?
In this particular case, because he had had now several cycles of FOLFOX before he presented to Mayo for just another opinion about treatment and to see a surgeon about potentially having something less than a right hepatectomy, we did repeat his CT scan and using a sequence on the CT scan to really focus on abnormalities in the liver, it turned out that he actually had about 10 nodules in the liver that were scattered through both lobes of the liver. Notably, those that had previously been seen were shrinking in size, so it does appear that he's having a response to therapy. But that really did change the surgical management, going from a setting where potentially we could have moved forward and done a less aggressive surgery, focusing on more wedge resections of the areas of involvement. Now with bilateral disease and 10 nodules, it means that he really probably would benefit from greater chemotherapy over a period of about 3 months, and then to reassess the ability to resect what's there.
I'm kind of curious. Clearly, the CAT scan that was done at your place showed 10 lesions. The one he'd had before showed only 2. It sounds like a situation where the technology was different. I mean, how often do you see this? It's kind of bothersome.
Unfortunately, we see it fairly often where even with modern CT equipment, there's certain sequences or the way the machine's programmed to enhance abnormalities in the liver. And it's easy, particularly in somebody that has some fatty infiltration in the liver or some other factors, to really miss smaller metastases. So it becomes very critical that the radiologist be aware that the scan's being done to really focus on the liver and establish the degree of metastatic disease involving the liver, not just a very rapid sequence to look for general evidence of metastatic disease, that it really has a major influence in how we treat patients and the recommendations that we make.
So that actually gets into a whole bunch of really great sections in this paper. First one, determining resectable versus potentially resectable disease. What were you trying to get across in the paper about this, and how do you determine resectability or near resectability?
One of the most critical things, and I think that we've tried to emphasize in that particular paper as well as in other forums in the past, that this is really a multi-specialty approach to patients where you need a good radiologist, you need a good liver surgeon, as well as the medical oncologist, and the focus has to be if we're going to take an approach of trying to remove the metastatic disease in the liver, it has to be disease that is potentially resectable in some manner or ablatable. But at the end, you have to have some confidence that whether you move directly to surgery or try to downsize things and then go on to surgery, that ultimately you're removing all of the disease that you can see.
So one of the sort of rules of thumb that's been out there is if you remove all the lesions, so in this case, like say 10 or more lesions, how much liver, normal liver, is going to be left? And I've heard the figure 30%. Is that the figure you use? And how would you have calculated it for him?
Right. It certainly is in most settings 30%, in extreme settings potentially down to 20%, but the other rule of thumb is two adjacent segments of the liver that can be preserved that still represent roughly about 30% of the liver. In this situation, given where the nodules were scattered, as the surgeon saw this particular patient, it would have meant a right hepatectomy and then either ablation or wedge resection of several things within the left lobe. In this particular patient, his left lobe is relatively small, so it would have required an additional step of venous embolization to try to create some hypertrophy in the left lobe and then allow resection of the right lobe.
You have another section in the paper about so-called conversion therapy. Is that the way you were looking at him, that you sort of alluded to this, that maybe by having tumor shrinkage, it would change the surgery? And how would it change the surgery?
Right. In this patient's setting, he had disease that was potentially resectable in the sense that you could remove the right lobe and take out the 8 nodules that were there and then ablate the 2 in the left lobe. But a lot of concern, there may be still underlying micrometastatic disease that we don't see in that setting, using neoadjuvant chemotherapy rather than conversion therapy to really try to eradicate that disease would be important. Conversion therapy would more be the patient where something was up against a vital structure, and if you could have some shrinkage of the tumor and get it to pull away from that vital structure, then potentially you could allow a patient to go on to surgery.
Now, did this patient have a PET scan? In the past, there's been discussion about getting a PET scan to rule out other occult sites of disease. There was actually some data presented at ASCO supposedly suggesting that you don't need to do it. Did you do it in him?
He did have a PET scan performed that did not show any evidence of extrahepatic disease or even disease within liver that we did not appreciate by the CT scan.
Is there agreement that a PET scan is indicated when you're thinking about surgery?
In patients that are higher risk like this, I think there is a general feeling that it is worthwhile, that you don't want to miss the occult peritoneal disease or lung metastases that had not been appreciated on the CT scan.
So as you sort of think out over the next 6 months or a year for this man, what are you thinking?
In his situation, the things that are critical, one is to make sure that we have control of his disease. Two, if we are going to proceed on to surgery, the disease within the right lobe would be removed with the right hepatectomy, but the disease within the left lobe has to be visible enough that you can perform an ablation or wedge resection of it. If he received therapy to a point where everything disappeared on the scan, it would then leave the surgeon in a setting where they would not know what to remove or ablate.
You also get into the issue in the paper of biologic agents in this setting, particularly bevacizumab and the anti-EGFR antibodies. Is that something that you were thinking about in this man? And incidentally, did you have a KRAS on him?
We did not have a KRAS. That has been ordered in his setting to determine the status of the gene. But it is a very important factor, certainly. One of the things that we want to do is, as quickly as possible, gain control of the metastatic disease, potentially shrink it to a point where it is resectable, but not create a lot of liver toxicity by longer exposure to chemotherapy. For that reason, in a setting where a patient is going to go to surgery to have their metastatic disease resected, I really do believe it's important to look at using a biologic agent, whether it's bevacizumab or one of the EGFR inhibitors.
And what about in this man?
In this man, he had been receiving bevacizumab. It was seemingly helping with his response, given that with the first several cycles of FOLFOX and bevacizumab, he was starting to see some shrinkage. Clearly, the one downside to bevacizumab would be that you would have to stop it approximately 4 to 6 weeks before surgery.
So he's getting actually FOLFOX Bev.
Correct.
And how is he tolerating it? Any hypertension, any Bev issues, any neuropathy?
Sure. In his setting, he has not had any significant side effects other than fatigue. He noted that after starting the chemotherapy with bevacizumab, he did have some increased fatigue. But fortunately, he's not had any problems with hypertension. He's had a little bit of epistaxis, very mild epistaxis, that's probably a combination of the 5-FU creating some mucosal irritation and then the bevacizumab enhancing the risk of some bleeding.
Now, just sort of thinking farther in the future, if he is able to undergo a resection successfully, what would you be thinking about post-op?
In a setting where he does seem to be having benefit at this point, and if that were established at surgery, then I would certainly recommend that he try to complete a total of 12 cycles of chemotherapy with FOLFOX and bevacizumab. So whatever he received preoperatively and then what he receives postoperatively.
Any comments on this controversial issue of pre-op or neoadjuvant therapy in the patient? Now, this patient, I guess, is a little different because he's not presenting with straightforward one lesion that could be easily resectable. But what about that situation? And I guess, where are things right now in terms of clinical research? There was a trial that was being launched and I think is launched through the NSABP looking at this.
Right. There still is a question, is there a benefit to perioperative chemotherapy versus just postoperative for the resectable patient? Part of the thought process has been that if we give perioperative chemotherapy, then we're immediately gaining control of any metastatic disease, either within the liver or outside the liver, and that ultimately that should lead to a better outcome versus immediately taking somebody to surgery and delaying the use of chemotherapy until a patient recovers. The one trial that really tried to look at perioperative versus no chemotherapy that had been done in Europe did not show a statistical significant benefit to the use of perioperative chemotherapy versus surgery alone. However, that trial really focused on the lowest risk patients, 1 to 3 liver metastases, where the risk of recurrence is certainly less with surgery. The NSABP trial, I think, will help try to better clarify for somewhat higher risk patients, is there a benefit to perioperative versus postoperative chemotherapy? And then that in turn would help guide when do we do surgery.
What is your usual approach to a patient who presents, unlike this one, you know, with a single easily resectable metastasis? Do you tend to use preoperative therapy? One of the things that people have talked about is, quote, letting the disease declare itself and the treatment declare itself. But right. What do you generally do in your own practice?
For a patient that's a year or more out from their initial adjuvant therapy and resection with a solitary metastasis, I tend to refer them directly to the surgeon and encourage proceeding directly to surgery. For a patient that is higher risk with either multiple metastases, even if it's 3 or 4 metastases in one lobe, or somebody who relapses very quickly after adjuvant therapy, there, I do think it's important to show that you can establish control of the disease prior to going on to surgery.
So let's talk about a couple more of your patients. How about this 56-year-old woman?
This is a young woman that I saw that had gone in for her first ever screening colonoscopy and had not had any symptoms at all during that colonoscopy. She is found to have a mass in the transverse colon that by biopsy was an adenocarcinoma. She did not have any other high-risk features at the colonoscopy, such as lots of polyps. She had no family history of any sort of cancer, particularly given her younger age. That was an important factor to clarify. She did go on to have surgery, and during the surgery, she had just a very early T3 tumor where the tumor was just beginning to focally involve the periclonic fat, and there was also a focal area of lymphovascular invasion that has been viewed as a higher risk factor. In her case, she had a good assessment of lymph nodes. There were 47 that were removed and were all free of metastatic disease. And finally, given her young age, she did have evaluation of the microsatellite enzymes to make sure that she didn't have any mismatch repair deficiencies, and indeed she did not. So she fits into this group of patients who has an average risk stage 2 colon cancer. In this setting, the surgeon operating on her said, given her young age, he would very strongly recommend that she receive chemotherapy to make sure that this doesn't come back. And so she's a patient, again, where we're left with the clinical information we have and trying to make some assessment, what's her risk of recurrence?
And what was her background? How educated had she become about the disease? How much did she want to know?
She's somebody that really had no medical knowledge at all. She came from a family where nobody was involved in the medical profession. And she had not really taken any time to go out onto the internet and read anything. She mainly came in saying, the surgeon told me I'm at high risk of this cancer coming back and that I should be getting chemotherapy. What do you think?
What did you think?
Well, I discussed with her that, yes, her young age is of some concern because we certainly don't want to see a cancer come back at any age, but particularly in a younger person. But in her setting, other than the focal lymphovascular invasion, there wasn't any other risk factor that would have, at least on clinical grounds, suggested that she would benefit from chemotherapy. And given that, I did discuss with her the potential use of the Oncotype DX assay.
And what was her kind of theoretical attitude about the possibility of chemotherapy? What was her concept of chemotherapy? What kind of chemo were you thinking about?
In her setting, I think if I had proceeded with chemotherapy, it likely would have been with FOLFOX, potentially with just capecitabine alone. But if I were to use chemotherapy in a younger patient like this, who I felt were at higher risk, I'd certainly want to try to maximize the benefit of the adjuvant therapy and therefore would have looked at the potential use of FOLFOX. In her setting, I think it really helped where she came in with this belief that she was at a very high risk of recurrence and that it was just a matter of time before the cancer came back. Trying to sit down and talk through what is the risk in her setting in general terms, what does chemotherapy do to help reduce that risk, and what are the side effects of chemotherapy? And at least in the balance, for most intermediate risk stage 2 colon cancer patients, the benefit from chemotherapy is going to be pretty low.
What did you say, or what were you thinking in your head was her absolute risk of recurrence?
My guess was it had to be somewhere between maybe 15 and 20%, given no really high risk factors that came out from the initial surgery or pathology evaluation.
And did you go ahead and get the Oncotype?
I did. And that came back showing that based on that particular assay that she had a score of 20 that translates to risk of about 13%. And sitting down then and reviewing that information with her, she felt much better about things. And indeed, with some time to think about it and with additional information, she had really made her own mind up that she was not going to pursue chemotherapy unless this particular test came back showing a high risk of recurrence.
So what's her current situation?
She's now just being followed periodically for any evidence of recurrence.
And just relevant to that, we get a lot of questions from oncologists about how people follow people. So like what kind of pattern of follow-up are you going to have for her?
In her case, because she is at a low risk of recurrence, I had suggested to her that I would see her every 6 months for the first 2 years and obtain a CEA at that time and then perform a CT scan once a year for the first 2 years.
And, you know, getting back to this lady with theoretically a 13% risk of recurrence, you know, I guess you can imagine it coming down a few percent with something. But in breast cancer, that's going to buy you chemotherapy, and IV chemotherapy, maybe even anthracycline, you know, AC, or, you know, docetaxel cyclophosphamide for a pretty small benefit. I don't know. To me, it's a lot different to think about a few percent benefit if you're going to take something like capecitabine.
Right. There is clearly a difference in how breast cancer patients are treated, the expectation of patients with breast cancer and what treatments they might receive versus what we typically do with a patient with resected colon cancer. In this setting, the results of MOSAIC or even the NSABP-C07 trial would suggest that there might be a 2 or 3% absolute reduction in the risk of recurrence for a patient in her setting. And, you know, that would be with an oxaliplatin-based treatment with either 5-FU given as an infusion or a bolus, and certainly now with the results of the CAPOX trial showing benefit in that setting, any of those would be options. But in her case, if we just said, well, let's use capecitabine alone or 5-fluorouracil alone, the likelihood of benefit there would be very small. And ultimately, for this particular patient, is it worth 6 months of therapy, the potential side effects, granted no long-term neuropathy, but certainly the inconvenience, the risk of certain complications to put her through this? You know, and that, I think, is something that obviously all of us struggle with. The worst possible scenario would be to see her back in 2 years, and now she suddenly has metastatic disease in multiple locations that is not potentially resectable for cure. Did we miss an opportunity? And that, I think, is one of the things that we always have to struggle with in trying to balance the potential benefit versus the downsides of therapy.
Now, you felt, I guess, confident enough to actually order an Oncotype DX assay for her. Are there any other assays out there that are being looked at in this situation that, for example, you might consider at this point, or you think maybe in the future we're going to be considering?
There are definitely other assays in development, and I see the Oncotype assay as the first generation to come along for colon cancer with others in development.
In terms of specifically looking at genes, you know, thinking back to George Sledge's ASCO presidential talk about the biology of targeted therapy, et cetera, you know, in the Oncotype and breast cancer, oncologists know that somehow they're looking at proliferation, they're looking at ER, they're looking at HER2, kind of things that we're familiar with. What about an Oncotype colon? What are they looking at? And are there genes in general that seem to predict not just prognosis, but benefit from chemo?
Right. In this particular assay with Oncotype, they have a 12-gene panel that looks at various factors that reflect things that drive the growth of colon cancer. It's not something, again, that really helps us pick certain drugs that would work better in colon cancer. The things that do seem to have importance for us, clearly KRAS is the gene that has really made a difference in terms of how we define therapies for our patients with colorectal cancer. BRAF has been of interest. Initially, it looked like BRAF was similar to KRAS, that if you had a mutation in BRAF, you would not benefit from the use of an EGFR inhibitor. It turns out that's not the case, that even if there is a mutation in BRAF, patients still have the potential to benefit. BRAF, though, rather than helping guide decisions in therapy, is really meant to look at the aggressiveness of the tumor. A patient with a BRAF mutated tumor has a much shorter life expectancy. The tumors tend to be much more aggressive, even if they respond to therapy, recur more quickly, and ultimately are more difficult to control. So that gene would have some relevance in terms of counseling patients about their disease. Beyond that, all the other things that have been looked at, such as ERCC1, that may have some ability to predict benefit from oxaliplatin, thymidylate synthetase that has some relevance to fluoropyrimidine, still haven't reached a point where I think people are comfortable using those to make treatment decisions. That's unfortunately an area in colorectal cancer where we do need to refine the tools that we have to better be able to personalize the treatments that we use for patients that we see.
I think when an oncologist hear the word BRAF nowadays, they think about all the stuff coming out in melanoma with the BRAF inhibitor vemurafenib, and I think other agents coming out there. What about the BRAF V600E mutation that's correlated with response to these agents? Am I correct in saying there are some patients with colorectal cancer who have that?
Yes, it's roughly about 12% of patients that have a mutation in V600E.
And do we know whether or not agents like vemurafenib cause responses?
We have not looked at those agents in colorectal cancer in any robust way to date. The very little information that exists does not at least seem to show the same sort of benefit that seen in melanoma. To date, the only study that's been reported that showed benefit to a specific treatment was a very small group. I believe it was 12 patients that received FOLFOXIRI along with bevacizumab that seemingly had a better benefit than what you would have expected for patients with a mutation in BRAF. It's a smaller group of patients with colon cancer. Clearly, we need to look at newer agents to try to overcome this poor prognosis for patients.
I mean, still 12% of 200,000 is a lot of people.
It is, absolutely. And I think it's, again, an interesting difference between things like breast cancer, even lung cancer and colon cancer, where particularly in breast cancer, there's been so much focus on the molecular dissection of patients into certain treatment options, where in colon cancer, up until KRAS, we hadn't been doing that. And certainly with BRAF, there's this thought, should we be focusing energies there? Can we ever accomplish a trial? They've clearly done it in breast cancer. There isn't a reason that with a focused effort in colon cancer, we couldn't do the same.
So let's close out by just very briefly talking about your 63-year-old man with rectal cancer.
Yes, this is a common scenario that a lot of us end up seeing. This is a gentleman that I saw that had the typical symptoms of some change in bowel habits and then an episode of bright red blood per rectum that went in to see his primary care physician. Initial workup did not show any hemorrhoids or a fissure. He therefore underwent a colonoscopy that showed a mass that was in the higher portion of the rectum by biopsy, again, an adenocarcinoma. Then in his workup, he proceeded on to have endoscopic ultrasound to really try to stage the tumor as well as a CT scan to look for evidence of any metastatic disease before making any treatment decisions. So in his setting, by the endoscopic ultrasound, it appeared that the tumor extended through the wall of the rectum right into the surrounding soft tissue, but not beyond that. And by the ultrasound, he did have several, at least one lymph node that had some hypoechoic changes that looked worrisome for metastatic disease, though the location of the lymph node would have required a biopsy right through the tumor to get to the lymph node, so they weren't able to biopsy the lymph node. And given what appeared to be a T3 tumor with nodal involvement, he went on to receive radiation and chemotherapy prior to surgery.
And were you taking care of him at that point?
I did take care of him, yes.
And what kind of chemo did you use with the radiation?
I ended up using capecitabine in his case as a radiation sensitizer. And he tolerated that very well up until about the last week when he was starting to have a lot of rectal irritation and some skin changes in the perineum. But other than that, he really didn't have a lot of side effects of therapy.
And what happened? He went to surgery?
He went on to surgery. And in his case, he had a very good response where there was an area of ulceration in the region where the tumor had been, but no evidence of any residual cancer, and 36 lymph nodes were removed, all free of any evidence of metastatic disease. He did have a TME surgery, so the total meso excision that took out that whole area around the rectal cancer that would have removed, hopefully, any micrometastatic disease that may have still been there.
And what's his current situation?
Right now, he's undergoing adjuvant therapy with FOLFOX with a plan to give him 4 months of FOLFOX based on the initial staging and what appeared to be a very good response to his initial therapy.
How would you have managed him if on endoscopic ultrasound the nodes all look good?
In that setting, because of the T3 tumor, I would still have recommended that he proceed on to neoadjuvant therapy. There's enough evidence to say, number one, that giving radiation preoperatively really does impact an overall survival and outcomes versus postoperative treatment. The other thing is that giving radiation prior to surgery seems to have less long-term complications than postoperative radiation that really does create a lot of bowel dysfunction.
Anything else you want to say about this case? Any teaching points you want to bring up?
I think there are a couple critical teaching points. One of the first points is in staging patients, we, I think, often just blindly accept the information that's given to us from either the ultrasound or, in many cases, an MRI that's performed. And at the time of surgery, you know, it's not uncommon to see somebody that looked like they had a T2 tumor and no lymph node involvement, went directly to surgery, and then we see them afterwards because it was truly a T3 and they had multiple lymph nodes involved. I think number one is clearly a recognition that these tools are meant to help guide our decision-making, but they're not foolproof. And certainly we've got to continue to look for newer, better ways to stage patients initially. The radiation isn't a benign treatment in the long term. It certainly can create a lot of difficulties for patients in either difficulty with bowel function, insufficiency, fractures, other problems. Ultimately, there's great importance in that initial staging. The other item I think that has come up frequently, and indeed I saw a patient recently that was even a younger patient, that was a gentleman in his mid-40s that had been treated elsewhere, and the decision was made to use capecitabine with the radiation. But because he was young, the medical oncologist treating him was very concerned about using 5 versus 7 days and felt that they really needed to maximize his chemotherapy initially and ended up giving him 7 days all the way through the radiation. He developed severe radiation-induced proctitis to a point that he ended up requiring a hospitalization for a short time for TPN before he could actually go on to surgery to allow things to settle down enough that they felt they safely could resect the tumor without any concerns about wound problems afterwards.
I meant to ask you what schedule of capecitabine you used in him.
Using 825 milligrams per meter square Monday through Friday.
What about the issue of radiation therapy in patients with higher rectal lesions?
Right, and that is the other really important point in this gentleman. In a patient with a high rectal cancer that's really up around the rectosigmoid junction, there is a lot of concern. Are we over-treating patients now using radiation in somebody who has a good response to chemotherapy based on the criteria that we have from imaging or evaluation by endoscopy? There is some thought and certainly some retrospective information to suggest that in a setting such as this particular patient, it may be that using chemotherapy alone would be fine. Clearly, that has not been established in a clinical trial. There is a clinical trial that's being proposed now through the cooperative group system that would take patients in this setting and either randomize them to the traditional approach of radiation and chemotherapy or to an arm where they would just receive chemotherapy initially for a defined period of time, go on to surgery, and at surgery, if there were still high-risk factors, then there would be the ability to go on and give radiation afterwards. But if there are no high-risk factors found at surgery, such as bulky tumor, lots of lymph nodes involved, then the patient would just complete chemotherapy.